supporting WHYY Penn Medicine, helping to find new cures for cancer. With life-saving clinical trials and advanced surgical techniques, Penn Medicine is offering more hope for patients everywhere. Learn more at PennMedicine.org/cancer. Penn Medicine, what's next?
I'm Dave Heller, and this is NewsWorks Tonight. Negotiations continue to keep Philadelphia Mayor Jim Kenney from vetoing a bill to impose a 1% tax on construction. WHYY's Tom McDonald reports the sticking point is finding another way to generate money for more affordable housing.
Since Philadelphia City Council passed the tax bill in June, Mayor Jim Kenney has been against the proposal, fearing it would stall development in the city. He believes he's not alone.
Almost half of council had serious concerns about it also. Our analysis that was requested by City Council, frankly, shows that or indicates that we may wind up taking in less money as a result of the construction tax putting a damper on new construction in the city.
Kenney's chief of staff, Jim Engler, says their counterproposal is to take the tax from buildings that are coming out of the current 10-year tax abatement and use that money to fund more affordable housing.
So if you think of the tax abatement is 10 years, that 11th year, the first year that a property is fully taxable, we would be dedicating all new real estate tax revenue to the housing trust fund, to affordable housing.
The plan would put $19 million into the trust fund this year, $9 million the next. Over 5 years, Engler says it would bring in nearly $53 million. Councilwoman Maria Quinones-Sanchez says she wants to see $20 to $25 million each year dedicated to improving the housing for families in the city who need it desperately.
We just want to get it done. We've talked, we've planned, we've debated, and now it's time to act.
Council President Darrell Clark issued a memo saying the construction tax would generate $22 million a year and says he believes the Kenney administration assertions the tax would cost more to administer than it would generate are untrue. He also doesn't believe it will hurt the construction business.
If there's an alternative strategy that gets us to 20, then I'm sure members of council will do their due diligence in terms of reviewing this and, you know, seeing if we can work together on this, and which we would love to do.
Sources tell WHYY Clark and Council don't have 12 votes necessary for a veto override. There were only 9 votes for the bill in the first place, and if the vote were held today, some of those votes could be shaky. Tom McDonald, WHYY News.
The United Nations Working Group on Arbitrary Detention has concluded that Iran had, quote, no legal basis for arresting and detaining a Princeton graduate student more than 2 years ago. For WHYY, Jeanette Beebe reports that this is giving advocates new hope for Shia Wang's release.
Wang's ordeal began in August 2016, when he was accused of espionage during a research trip in Iran. He has spent more than 850 days behind bars and endured over 2 weeks in solitary confinement. The UN working group found that his health is so poor that he should be released immediately and, quote, urgently transferred to a hospital. Lee Toomey is the group's vice chair on follow-up. She says she anticipates it may take up to 6 months for Iran to respond to the report.
We think that there is reason for hope. There have been people released after our opinions issued in relation to quite a few countries, including Iran. So there certainly is a possibility. But I would not want to raise expectations too much.
Hua Chu, his wife, filed the petition that prompted the working group to evaluate Wang's case. She says she has struggled to maintain a normal life for her son, who started kindergarten this week.
This has been unbearable. And actually, from a wife perspective, I was shocked that he has survived so far. I hope the United States government can bring him some as soon as possible.
Wang's supporters say he's being used as a political pawn and that he's a scholar, not a spy. The true test, they say, will come during the UN assembly in New York later this month, an opportunity for the U.S. and other countries to push for Wang's release. For WHYY News, Jeanette Beebe.
With nearly 2 months to go before Election Day, outside groups have already spent more than $4 million to influence voters in congressional races in the Philadelphia region. WHYY's Dave Davies reports that examining which races are targeted tells a story about what Republicans and Democrats expect from the midterms.
If you live in the Philadelphia media market these days, you're getting a lot of this.
These people are angry. Angry at Congressman Tom MacArthur.
Why? You have to wonder about Scott Wallace.
Meet Washington insider Andy Kim. Kim spent his adult life in D.C.
They sound like standard campaign fare, maybe, but none of those ads was aired by a candidate for office. Who paid for them? They tell you at the end of the ads, in a hurry.
Congressional Leadership Fund is responsible for the content of this advertising.
The Republican Jewish Coalition is responsible for the...
House Majority PAC is responsible for the content of this advertising.
The groups are generally super PACs associated with the national Republican and Democratic parties or groups with ideological agendas. And there's no limit on what they can contribute and spend under the Citizens United decision. While candidates file campaign finance reports only once every 3 months, independent groups must file reports pretty much immediately when they spend money, which gives us a real-time sense of their priority targets. In this region, there are two races in New Jersey, where Republican incumbents Tom MacArthur and Leonard Lance are challenged by Democrats Andy Kim and Tom Malinowski, and two in Pennsylvania, the Bucks County battle between Republican incumbent Brian Fitzpatrick and Democrat Scott Wallace, and the open seat in the Lehigh Valley, where Republican Marty Nothstein faces Democrat Susan Wild. 11 congressional races in our region attracted no independent spenders, zero. Robin Kolodny, who chairs the political science department at Temple, says that tells a story, too.
When you're not finding any early independent spending, and that is telling you that they don't think those are winnable races from their end. You don't go ahead and spend money in races you don't think you have a chance of winning.
If she's right, that means one of the big stories of the midterm will be the election of three new Democratic women from the Philadelphia suburbs. Chrissy Houlihan in Chester County, Mary Gay Scanlon in Delaware County, and Madeline Dean in Montgomery County. They're in newly drawn districts that the National Republican Party seems to have abandoned. Dean's Republican opponent, businessman Dan David, says he knows what he's up against.
Yeah, I don't have any endorsements or any help from the National Party, and that's fine. If they don't endorse me or they don't come through, then we'll win without them.
David's invested $160,000 of his own money into the race and says he's building momentum. Former prosecutor Pearl Kemp, the Republican candidate in Delaware County, is a woman who's gotten some national media attention and has invested $200,000 into her race. She says she's running hard. The independent groups also have to disclose in their reports whether their spending is to support a candidate they like or oppose one they don't. So far, three-quarters of the spending in our region has funded attack messages on television, digital ads, and mailings. As for the partisan split, so far pro-Republican spending is about three times the amount for Democratic candidates. Dave Davies, WHYY News.
In Delaware's primary election last week, political observers focused on the U.S. Senate contest between incumbent Senator Tom Carper and progressive newcomer Kerry Harris. Many thought Carper was vulnerable, but he vanquished his Democratic challenger with ease. There was a big surprise, though. That was the victory in the Republican primary race for Congress by an unconventional candidate, as WHYY's Chris Barish reports.
When I suggested to Scott Walker that his campaign wasn't even a grassroots operation, he wholeheartedly agreed.
Right, I'm like dust, like below that, like substrata.
Walker's unorthodox campaign can be described as the quest of one peculiar man who drives a jalopy that doubles as a billboard. The 1991 Toyota station wagon is filled with wooden signs that he hand-paints with nature landscapes and then plants in areas with lots of vehicular traffic. The 67-year-old father of four often slept in that wagon over the winter after a dispute with his wife. He ekes out a living providing flowers to a few hotels and shopping centers in the region. Walker used to run sober houses, but he said he lost them to foreclosure. He's also a self-described alcoholic who sought refuge in a sober house in this February Facebook Live post.
Hey, I'm looking for a sober bed tonight because I have a drinking problem, and I can't seem to lick it with medications or any other way. I need help with my addiction right now because I don't want to go through another night. I have too much at stake. And the people of Delaware would expect me to be in tip-top shape all the time.
Walker never went into rehab and told WHYY he still drinks 5 or 6 beers a day as he campaigns to defeat first-term Democratic incumbent Congresswoman Lisa Blunt Rochester. Ironically, Walker challenged Rochester in 2016 in the 6-candidate Democratic primary. He won just 5% of the vote. This year, he ran in the GOP primary against Lee Murphy, a retired Amtrak manager and actor who had a role in the Netflix series House of Cards. Loyalists expected Murphy to coast. Instead, Walker won by 6 points. Driving home to Milford that night, Walker said he had resigned himself to defeat.
I said, that's it. Yeah, I'm done. I'm going to go back to gardening tomorrow and go to work.
Then a radio host called.
He says, you win. I was stunned while I was driving.
His wife reached out, too.
She kept texting me. Yeah, you're on the news. You know, you won it. They got a check mark next to your name.
So now Walker is a torchbearer for the GOP. His name just below Senator Carper's challenger, Rob Arlett, on the ballot. Yet party executive director Emily Taylor wouldn't commit to supporting Walker in a state where Democrats have a 2-to-1 voter advantage.
We'll have to, since there were surprising results, decide what's the best way to maximize the limited resources we have as a party.
Walker, who is white, nevertheless thinks he can win enough votes in predominantly black Wilmington to defeat Delaware's first black member of Congress. His platform? A free market economy and a stronger national defense through an anti-ballistic missile system. And the candidate who recently lost 60 pounds is also railing against obesity as a national health crisis. That stance has led to striding criticism of him on social media this week in light of this Facebook video about a plus-size model whose photo was on a store window.
And the model, as you can see, is very, very obese. And this is a protest because women should not get the idea that it's okay to be unhealthy.
Amid cries that he is engaging in despicable fat shaming, Walker insisted he's trying to save the country trillions of dollars in medical costs and eventual doom.
They should be ashamed that they're not taking care of themselves. But if somebody does not speak up about this, we're going down. And we'll be speaking Chinese here in a few years.
Rochester's campaign did not return calls for this story. From the Delaware desk, Chris Barish, WHYY News.
As part of almost 200 shows at the Philly Fringe Festival, Center City's Wilma Theater has opened its season with a new play that looks in on 4 black men who've died. They're strangers waiting to find out what happens next. WHYY's Howard Shapiro says the show is a high mark of this year's festival. He offers this review.
Kill Move Paradise at the Wilma is a stunning new play and a riveting production. And if you're up for theater that challenges you to see something in a new way, this show's for you. 3 black men and one who's not yet a man are dropped, one by one, onto a white stage that ramps severely upward toward the theater's rear wall. The isolated place isn't heaven. It's more of a waiting room. All the characters have died in some fashion, and the details about the end of their lives are unclear to us. It takes each one a while to figure out that they're all dead. Each tries hard to remember how or where it happened.
Looking down at my daughter in her crib.
You? The 28 bus. You? Breakfast. Regular stuff.
Something ain't right.
Keep trying to remember.
Wait! Is this a support group?
Wait. They wait urgently for whatever will be the next step in their journey. As they get to know each other, a fax machine on the stage floor intermittently shoots out the names of people with matching fates. It's clear that none of them died from natural causes. Kill Move Paradise is an 80-minute look at how they adapt, what they learn from each other, and who they were and essentially still are. It's as funny as it is intense, laden with the vivid street talk of the hood and dialogue that feels always real. It's written by the Philadelphia-based theater artist James Iams, whose career has taken off over the years on Philadelphia stages, first as an actor and then as a director and playwright. He's a member of Hot House, the Wilma Theater's core troupe. The rigors for that group of artists are both intellectual and physical, and Wilma's artistic director Blanca Ziska stages Kill Move Paradise to be as demanding physically as it is in the way it explores ideas. The actors are the impressive ensemble of Lindsay Smiling, Anthony Martinez Briggs, Brandon Pierce, and Avery Hannon. From the first knockout minute to the last beautiful image, Kill Move Paradise is a rewarding piece. It runs through September 23rd. For WHYY, I'm Howard Shapiro.
And staying with the theater, next week, Juniper Productions launches a series of cocktail plays, evenings of short plays written by Philadelphia playwrights. The 3 actors in the performances, Mary Pat Walsh, Joel Wheeler, and Marissa Kennedy visited WHYY to offer a taste of one of the plays. In Delivery, playwright Alexandra Espinosa asks, in a world without potable water, how far will you go to save yourself, your family, and your community? In what seems to be a post-apocalyptic world, Pam and her son Joel are surviving by purifying their own water in an abandoned distillery. As the scene opens, they're startled by the arrival of Stella, who claims she's the daughter of Pam's former friend, Luna.
What happened to her?
There's some kind of virus going through the crew set up in the port. She wanted to help.
Sounds like Luna. Well, she clearly didn't teach you the system.
It happened pretty fast.
Your mom leaves one bucket outside of the door and waits 5 minutes. When I see that bucket, I unlock the front door and wait 5 minutes. Then I open the door and hide behind the bar. We both wait 5 minutes. Then your mom walked in. And you, Joel, you always secure the perimeter before the above and the below. God, kids are useless. Well, we should get to it, shouldn't we? Those buckets are yours.
Just two?
It's always just two. Well? Sorry for your loss.
Have there been any viruses here? You both look pretty healthy and...
Our health is none of your business. Your mom never asked questions. Your mom just...
It's gone through the port, the stadium, and the mall. All the settlements that have been popping up, all that's delayed now. There's no workforce for foraging now. People are either too dead, too weak, or too depressed to keep working, and it's just funny. And all this time, going from crew to crew, compound to compound, this is the first time I've seen just two. Two healthy-looking people. My mom never mentioned it was just two of you.
You moved around that much?
Joel, no questions right now. So, what did your mom mention?
Said you could clean the water here. Said she liked looking at the pipes and trying to trace where one started and stopped. Said there were a bunch of flags. Never said it was just two of you. Said she knew you from before.
Hippy-dippy crap. Typical.
Did you?
Did I what?
Know her from before.
What did I say about questions? She ever tell you all the times I gave when it could have been my ass on the line? Opening up on nights where I could literally smell the gunpowder from whatever clusterfuck was happening on the outside? Or when she came up in here with a leaky bucket and I gave her one of my own? I guess that didn't make it into the bedtime stories, huh?
She said you were good to her.
Well, there you go.
But that doesn't mean you were good to the rest of us.
What in Christ's name is this, huh? Do I look like some kind of Mrs. Schindler to you? I don't have to do what I do. I liked your mother. I don't like you. Don't make me feel any less generous than I already do. Go. Go. I don't have time for this. Joel, do something for once. Get her out of here. I have to go and do the actual work. And use the gun if you have to.
I tried.
How many people?
Where?
Where you live.
32. There were 46, but a group of people left trying to go west. God knows why. And then there were four, like my mom.
They all got sick.
Yeah.
32 people?
Yeah.
I haven't seen anyone but my mother in 3 years.
What about my mom?
Today was my graduation from security training. My mom used to make me hide during pickups. Now she wants me to be useful.
So what have you been doing for 3 years? Hiding?
No. No, I mean, there's a lot to do here. There's a lot of maintenance you have to do on the equipment. And I've developed a new system for keeping track of time, so technically it's 3 years, 3 months, and 17 days.
Good luck with that.
Stella. Stella Jones.
How do you know my last name?
We were lab partners in ninth grade.
Joel Campanelli? You've grown up.
Have you seen anyone else? Like, in the 32, are there people from...
No.
Stella Jones, I can't believe it's you. Can I help?
You can open the door.
How much water do you need?
That's a scene from Delivery by Alexandra Espinoza, performed by Mary Pat Walsh, Joel Wheeler, and Marissa Kennedy. The full play is part of Juniper Productions' Cocktail Plays, being staged at the Philadelphia Distilling Company next Tuesday and Wednesday. We end tonight's show with a programming announcement. This is the final week for Newsworks Tonight, and starting Monday at this time, you'll be hearing All Things Considered. And, of course, you'll hear the great work of our local news team throughout the day. In October, WHYY will be launching a new local news show and podcast. Stay tuned for details. Newsworks Tonight is produced by Shai Ben-Yaakov, Kimberly Haas, and Brett Rader. Thanks for listening. I'm Dave Heller, Newsworks Tonight.